Okay, it looks like we are all assembled. Before we begin argument today, I'm going to have the court's marshal show you how we keep time. When it's time for you to begin, you'll see a green start card. When you get to be 5 minutes from the conclusion of your argument, a yellow 5 minute card, and then a red stop card. So the colors may be a little bit helpful. I will likely hold you to the 5 minutes, and I know sometimes you might be reading a quote or something from the record, and so you're not looking at it, so don't let that be a concern to you. If you are answering a justice's question, I will always let you finish your answer to the question that was posed, but likely not let you get on to another topic. So with those introductions, we are going to call our second case of the day. We are sitting six on this case because Justice Brian Hagedorn has not participated and will not participate in this case. So we begin now with Village of Slinger versus Pope Property. Are you ready to proceed, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Terry Booth. I represent Don Toma and Polk Properties. There have been a lot of issues raised in this case, but I think I can distill them down into three basic categories. The first is forfeitures for asserted zoning code violations. The second is retroactive reassessment of taxes. And the third is costs, fees, and fines for asserted violation of an injunction. I'm going to deal with those in turn. But first, I want to address a couple preliminary matters that I think are overriding concerns. The first relates to judicial estoppel. The parties to this case and the property involved are the same as the parties and property that were involved in Toma versus Village of Slinger, 2018, Wisconsin 45. In that case, Slinger received increased tax income from a non-agricultural classification of the property, a position that it supported. That non-agricultural classification then began in 2014 and continued onward.
Counsel, in regard to that non-agricultural classification for the property, was it Slinger's position, as you understand it, that what Polk Properties and Mr. Toma was doing were agricultural activities or not?
Slinger did not oppose the circumstances where it was not proven that there were agricultural uses of the property.
Okay, I probably phrased my question poorly. Okay. Your client asserted before us in the past that what he was doing was agricultural use of the property, so the property should be taxed according to its use, which you asserted on your client's behalf was agricultural. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, was that conduct, the actions that your client took, the same actions as are now being asserted by Slinger to be agricultural actions?
I'm not sure I understood.
Is he doing the same thing now, and that's why he's being penalized as he was doing before when the case came up to us? Is he still cutting the hay on the property, and that's part of what's causing forfeitures and fines?
Correct.
So is his conduct, I'm trying to look at the activities
sure.
that were underlying the last time you were here, and the last time Polk Properties and Mr. Toma were here, he was arguing what he's doing was agricultural. And Slinger was arguing, no, it's not agricultural. And Slinger prevailed.
Correct.
And so my concern now is this conduct that now is causing forfeitures and costs for a violation of an injunction, is it the same conduct that he was doing before this case was brought to us? Our decision, I think, is 2018, so before that time.
Your Honor, that's a hard question to answer because the conduct is the same.
Okay.
But the other case was decided as a matter of what was proven at the Board of Review. Mm-hmm. So whether or not that evidence was fully presented at the Board of Review it was the basis for the court's earlier decision.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
Yeah, the position that we're taking now, it is based on that determination that there is non-agricultural use at this time. But the point of judicial estoppel is that there was a benefit received by the village of Slinger based on a non-agricultural classification in that case.
Counsel, I want to make sure that I understand your position. And you just said your position is that, I'm referring to page 23 of your brief, but I could refer to other parts also. The heading of your argument on page 23 of your brief is a legal non-conforming use is not abandoned by obtaining a zoning change alone. And it seems to me that you are arguing that you're maintaining a legal non-conforming use. Is that what you're arguing here on page 23 and elsewhere?
Yes.
And then isn't that by definition indicating that agriculture is continuing?
Your Honor, answer the court's question this way. I was about to, as my second initial point, was about to make the point that there's a lot of problem in this case, and there has been a lot of problem in this case, by referring to things as agricultural or farming, as opposed to looking at what the actual activity was. And the actual activity that is at issue here is cutting and removing the vegetation on this property. Whether that's agricultural, whether that is farming, doesn't really matter. What we're saying here with the legal nonconforming use is that there was cutting and removal of vegetation from the property before the zoning change, and that continued after the zoning change. There has been no change in that. And so
go ahead. Finish.
And for that reason, there's a legal non-conforming use. Whether that legal non-conforming use was agriculture or farming or something else, it doesn't matter. It is the fact that's important is that that use continued. It was the same use before, and it was the same use after, and it has continued to this day.
I understand that the cutting and the removal that you refer to on page 23 of your brief happened before and happened after the dates that you indicate. And I understand that your position, but it seems to me by definition, if you're maintaining, and I'm reading from page 23, I read earlier from the heading of your argument, but in the second paragraph, the whole page is the same thing, but in the second paragraph, the CNR, which of course is the cutting and the removal that you're referring to, activity on the property was a legal non-conforming use. And my question is, by definition, a legal non-conforming use means that agriculture continues. Isn't that the legal non-conforming use that you're referring to?
Your Honor, I no, No, Your Honor, I disagree with your characterization of it as agriculture.
Okay, fine. Let me ask you then. This will be the pointed question of it. Then yeah. You say that the CNR activity on the property was a legal non-conforming use. What was the legal conforming use? Let me ask it the other way.
And Your Honor, that's why I posed the issue as I did, because frankly, and this is the point that I was going to raise as the second preliminary point, is that this property was zoned residential, but it had a conservancy overlay, a COS overlay. That overlay was there because this property has a lot of open space that is going to be used by all of the residents jointly. That overlay specifies that among the uses for that property, among the uses for that property under the COS overlay are a fallow field, a managed meadow, or agricultural uses, including growing of crops for livestock consumption. So arguably, this was perfectly fine under the zoning, but taking the more difficult position, we're saying that regardless of that, and that's why we've stayed away from characterization as agriculture and farming, because this court has in recent cases defined those terms a little bit better and has indicated that indications of farming and agriculture are things like tilling the soil and planting and harvesting. And we noted in the brief that, in fact, Mr. Hagerty, the only person, the only witness presented by the Village of Slinger, indicated that from 2009 through 2017, he did not see any indication of any tilling of the soil. He did not see any indication of planting. The only thing that he saw once in a while was that the fields were mowed and that the vegetation was collected and taken away. And so he
counsel, can I ask you about that, what you just said? Because I'm looking at the evidentiary hearing that the court made findings of fact on September 5th of 2017. And I get what you're saying about the about some of the activity that took place, but the court found that there was a local farmer who was planting and harvesting crops and continued to do so after issuance of an injunction on December 6th of 2012. And then as of 2015 was still left whatever crops were there and just was applying some kind of herbicide. And at some point looks like there wasn't more harvesting or planting, but you just defined agriculture. Didn't the court find differently?
Your Honor, that is the problem with the use of the term farming and agriculture. Yes, Mr. Melius, who's the farmer who was cutting the grass, said, yeah, I farmed it all the way through. But what does that farming consist of? That farming did not consist, and Mr. Melius testified about this, he did not till the soil. He did not plant. All he did was he cut the grass and he picked it up and he carried it away. So that's why I've stayed away from those characterizations. Those characterizations have been problematic. And then when we get back to, so the court, trial court was accurate. Mr. Melius said, yeah, I farmed it. But Mr. Melius as a matter of fact, also testified that what he did is he just cut the grass and he took it away.
Isn't that what you, going back to what Justice Ann Walsh Bradley started with, isn't that what you argued was agriculture to us in the prior case? That activity?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
being honest.
That's what has happened. The court has made that decision. The court has made the decision that was wrong, and that the determination was that it was not proven that it was agricultural use. So we have that situation now, and now we're saying, okay, fine. We still have an argument, a situation where we are being fined for those same activities that were found to be non-agricultural.
Go ahead.
Counsel, it seems to me then, if you're going to argue estoppel vis-a-vis your opposing party, you want to come with clean hands, and yet it seems to me that in the Toma case, you were arguing that it was agricultural. If I recall, in paragraph 21, the court said your argument was doomed, and more words to follow. That's my adding to the opinion. So you're inconsistent, and also, and I'm not saying inconsistency is necessarily bad, you can call it flexibility, and I agree with that, but you can't point on the other side and say they're inconsistent when in the Toma case, you argued that the CNR was agricultural.
Your Honor, the court has made that determination in that earlier case, and we've accepted it. So we are arguing in accordance with what the what this court decided.
Counsel, based on the 2018 decision, I'm not sure why you, in order to prevail, you need to argue that the use was not in fact agricultural, because the court did not make that determination in 2018. What we said is that your client didn't present sufficient evidence to the Board of Review to support an agricultural classification of the property under the tax assessment law. So the court never said that it wasn't agricultural. I just, to press the point a little bit that I think my colleagues are asking you about, I'm not sure why you can't consistently argue in this case that in fact the use was agricultural, because it was under your argument.
Your Honor, I agree entirely with what you are saying. And the bottom line point of our position here doesn't really relate to, is it agricultural? Is it not agricultural? The point here on the first issue of forfeitures is, was the use that is complained of, the CNR use, is it the same before and after the zoning change? So whether it's agricultural, whether it's not agricultural, it just doesn't make any difference. The fact of the matter is that it is the same. And for that reason, it is grandfathered in effectively, and it is a it's a use that is allowed.
So I want to make sure I'm understanding the argument that you're advancing here. Your argument is it really doesn't matter what the court calls it. The use is non-conforming, and the use was not abandoned, and therefore your client shouldn't have been subjected to forfeitures and had damages award imposed against it. Is that a fair summary?
True, absolutely true. The forfeitures were imposed, the basis for forfeitures is a violation of the zoning code. And the zoning code allows, the zoning code allows forfeitures only for the violation of a zoning code ordinance. And there was no zoning code violation here because the CNR activity before is the same as the CNR activity after. And therefore, it is a legal non-conforming use under the statutes. Then to move on from that point, there have been a couple defenses that have been raised as to the legal non-conforming use. One is that it was abandoned, voluntarily abandoned. We've dealt with that issue in our briefing. The Duffy case is the only authority that was cited for that proposition. The Duffy did not have any authority or explanation for it. It is inconsistent with the laws in other jurisdictions. It's inconsistent with Wisconsin law. And frankly, it's bad public policy. We look to a two-element test, whether there's an intent to abandon and whether there is actual non-use. That is the standard that really is used in Wisconsin under the Manders and Moore case. And if we look at those elements, we do not have any actual act of non-use. We have use that has continued. We have the CNR activity that has continued. So there has not been any abandonment under Wisconsin's theory of abandonment. A second defense was that the non-conforming use was extended or enlarged. This is based on Wisconsin statute 62.23 sub 7 sub H. That statute says that, quote, the non-conforming use may not be extended. We don't have a non-conforming use being extended here. In fact, we have, by virtue of the installation of some of the evidence of a residential subdivision, we have the non-conforming use actually contracting. So neither of the defenses are applicable here. And so,
can I take you back, counsel, to your abandonment argument?
Sure.
How do you address the other agreements that were entered into here with respect to the Declaration of Covenants and the developer's agreement, and how do those play into the argument of abandonment?
Those are an indication of an intent to ultimately not use the property, but to use it for residential use. But there are two elements that are required. One is the element of actual non-use, and the second element is that of intent. So there may be some intent to eventually not use it, but there is still actual use. And the I forget which case it was, Morehouse or the other, had a situation where there was actual non-use in the fraternity house situation of the property. Right. But there was an intent to later return to that. The other case had just the opposite situation where the intent and the actual non-use were reversed. So those two cases indicate both sides that each one of the two elements is necessary for abandonment.
Right, but are those cases distinguishable at all because they don't involve an agreement that was entered to not use the property for which an injunction was sought and achieved ultimately because there was an agreement to not use the property for other than residential purposes? Shall be occupied and used only for single family residential purposes and for no other purpose.
It is a difference, Your Honor, but I think that it is not a valid distinction as far as the ultimate application of the law.
Mr. Booth, I'm looking at that same Declaration of Covenants, conditions and restrictions of the Pleasant Farms Estates, and I'm looking at Section 5.1 under permitted uses, which is what Justice Dallet was just reading from. And I'm looking at that whole section here, and I'm hearing you say that, yes, your client entered into this agreement, but it didn't go into effect immediately. When was it supposed to go into effect? And is there anything in this agreement that your client entered into that said it was going to start at some date in the future instead of whenever it was signed?
Your Honor, the document that was referred to, the 5.1, that is a document of covenants and restrictions for the owners of the subdivision. It is something that is between the owners of the subdivision. The Village of Swinger is only a third-party beneficiary of that. That is something that more properly looks to when the subdivision is fully developed, and it specifies what the rights and obligations among the party or among the property owners are to be. And that is why, also specifies that that you need to install a lawn within a period of time after you develop your house, and so that's obviously does not occur until there is development of the property.
So is what you're saying is this doesn't 5.1 is not giving directions to the developer, but to those who purchase lots and build houses in the subdivision?
Primarily, yes, Your Honor. Although it does, the village has the right to enforce those provisions, but the alternate provision, the other provision, is 10.1, which specifies that until all of the properties are sold, the developer has the right to do whatever is necessary on the other properties that have not been sold and that are common properties that will facilitate the sale of the properties. And there was testimony time and again from Mr. Melius, from Mr. Toma, that mowing the grass there is something that made the property more desirable and facilitated the sale of the property. And I would point to the photographs that were part of the record that showed the results of this mowing. Those photographs are exhibits 103 to 108. Those were taken in 2013. It shows basically a lawn. 2015, exhibits 109 to 120, it shows basically a lawn. That's what was done here. The property was mowed, and the clippings were taken off. In fact, the Village of Swinger requires mowing of lawns in order to keep weeds down. And the Village of Swinger also has provision for disposing of lawn clippings at its disposal site.
Thank you, Counsel. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your time is up. You'll have 5 minutes more when you come back in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Are you prepared now to proceed on behalf of the Village of Swinger?
I am, Your Honor.
Please do.
The court, Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel. My name is Stan Riffle. I am of the law firm of Municipal Law and Litigation Group, and I am very pleased to represent the Village of Swinger and appear before you today, as I have before on many occasions, but it's always been in Madison. And I, with all due respect, I don't particularly care for this venue here. It seems to me it's kind of reminiscent of the Brady Bunch, looking at all of the faces here. I was going to start.
That could be dangerous. Who is who?
I was going to start with addressing this judicial estoppel argument, but Justice Rebecca Bradley hit it right on the nose. TOMA 1, all it dealt with was the proceedings before the Board of Review that was attempting to look at what the actual use of the property was. Assessor, of course, changed the assessment from agricultural to residential use. He did it for reasons that had nothing to do with the actual use of the property, because it was being utilized for agricultural purposes. However, the TOMA folks did not prove that the assessor was wrong. They produced no evidence to the contrary. And so it has absolutely no bearing on this case.
Well, it may have no bearing, but how can you stand there before us and say it was being used for agricultural purposes when the position of Slinger, regardless of how we phrased our final decision, was that it was not being used for agricultural purposes? I mean, it either was or wasn't. I don't understand your dichotomy here.
Well, first of all, the Village of Slinger is not the Village of Slinger Board of Review, and the Village of Slinger Assessor is a statutory officer who must do
his... Of course, I understand the difference, counsel, but you, Village of Slinger, were the participants, not the assessor before us. It was the village who maintained a position, right?
It was the Board of Review. The village has nothing to say about what the Board of Review concludes. Regardless, it's been the consistent position of the Village of Slinger that these folks have engaged in agriculture from the time they got the rezoning until 2017, when the courts put an end to it. And they've admitted as much in their briefs to this court. They've styled their activity as CNR, this cutting and removal. But what they've admitted to is the CNR activity involved leasing the land to a local farmer who cut and baled hay on the usual seasonal basis and trucked those bales of hay off to feed livestock. And now, where I come from, that's farming and that's agricultural activity.
Well, if it's agricultural, why don't you change the zoning back to an agricultural tax then, instead of insisting on a residential tax? Why doesn't the village do that?
Because we can't do that. The TOMA, the petitioners have property rights that are vested that we cannot take away. They've made their choice. They made so many choices in this case, and choices have consequences. They chose to buy the property. They chose to annex the property to the village. They consciously petitioned the village to rezone the property so they could benefit from that rezoning. They petitioned for and received approval to divide the property by subdividing it. They prepared and recorded a subdivision plat. They chose to draft restrictions. They're required to draft these restrictions for the benefit of the city to put use restrictions on the property. They constructed roads, sewers, and other public infrastructure that they dedicated to the village. They sold residential lots. They converted this whole property to a residential subdivision.
And well, now, Council, that's all true to a point, but then the economy tanked around 2008, 2009, and they couldn't sell lots. So there's still a number of lots on this acreage that have not been developed into residential use. Is that
that's true?
Okay. And, you know, I agree with you. I'd characterize what has been presented in this case as an agricultural use, and doesn't the tax law base classifications for assessment purposes on actual use, regardless of the existence of the declarations?
That is true. So it gets us to the concept of what's a legal nonconforming use and what rights emanate from that. And I think going back to the origins of that concept is important. When municipalities first started implementing zoning restrictions on private property, obviously these are the first restrictions that were ever in place. And constitutionally, municipalities had to respect the rights of individuals who had their properties rezoned for a use that was contrary to their wishes to protect those rights. Otherwise, if you force those property owners to conform, it would constitute a taking, which we all know constitutionally you can't do except for very limited and specific public purposes, and then only with just compensation. So throughout the history of these fights relating to legal nonconforming use rights, almost every single case that we look at is a case of involuntary rezoning as opposed to a voluntary rezoning. To recognize that a property owner that wants to utilize his or her property before the rezoning, during the rezoning, and after the rezoning should be respected. However, there aren't, I've found zero cases jurisdictionally across the country that deal with voluntary rezonings and how they deal with abandonment, except for Duffy. So you can talk about the two-pronged test in Wisconsin that was in Manders and Morehouse, where it's intent and actual non-use, actual act of non-use. But that has always been applied in Wisconsin to involuntary rezonings. Here, we take the position, and I thought that perhaps it occurred to me that the court accepted this on cert to answer one question, and that is, does a property owner forfeit his or her legal non-conforming rights when he or she petitions for a rezoning? And the answer to that question is yes. The voluntary rezoning equals a voluntary relinquishment. And going back to this idea of abandonment or relinquishment, it's not a new concept in Wisconsin law. It goes back to at least 100 years to Manders, where the court said a legal non-conforming right is a right extended to a person and to be enjoyed by him or her until they didn't use him or her. I'm throwing it in until the voluntary until he or she voluntarily relinquishes it or abandons it. It's my position that making a conscious choice to make an application to rezone your property evinces intent not to use the property in the same manner before, during, and after the rezoning. It, in fact, is an intent and an actual legal act to abandon that because you're going to avail yourself of the rights that you obtain to utilize that property in the manner that you are requesting.
Also, going back to my earlier question, so I think I agree with you that voluntary rezoning manifests certainly an intent to abandon the non-conforming use at some point in time. But going back to the tax laws and Wisconsin's cases, we also have to determine that there was an actual cessation of the non-conforming use. And we don't have that here, right? Because the agricultural use or whatever we want to call it continued.
They continued to use the property for agriculture. The question here is whether they abandoned the right to use it for that purpose and whether or not their legal non-conforming rights were extinguished. It's our position that they were extinguished and that activity constituted an illegal non-conforming act because of the abandonment. And they didn't abandon this property just on the basis of making the application for the rezoning. They abandoned it when they converted the property, when they put in the roads and the sewer, and they sold a lot. And I think that is really clearly pointed out in Menominee Falls versus Price, where you had a property owner, and this was an involuntary rezoning, a property owner that had a home in an industrial zoning. And that property owner made a choice to put a industrial addition, addition to that home that was used for industrial purposes. And same as here, where you had, forget about the fact that you voluntarily rezoned it and abandoned it that way. You had ag use, and they put in these roads, and then they subdivided it, and they actually sold homes, lots in this property. And Menominee Falls Price said, as a matter of law, when an owner of a nonconforming use modifies that use, the municipality is entitled to terminate the entire nonconforming use.
And Council, I thought you told us the use is the same before. I didn't think you said there was a modification. I thought they were cutting the vegetation or the hay, whatever you call it,
they were
before and after the subdivision declaration was made.
However, in addition to doing that, that's not the only thing they did. If they were only farming before, during, and after, and they didn't come in and there was an involuntary rezoning their property, certainly. But the second that they put in all of this infrastructure, they modified it. They said,
I haven't been able to find any Wisconsin case that doesn't require cessation of the activity and equals abandonment. I haven't found any Wisconsin case.
You won't find it. It doesn't exist. And that's because every case has dealt with involuntary rezoning of somebody's property that wants to continue to use the property the same before, during, and after. Not expand it, not, of course, the sites cases that I was involved in, Pewaukee Marina, they did extend the property, and so they lost their legal non-conforming rights in that manner. But I hearken back to the fact that this two-pronged test has not been used in a situation like this, not only in the state of Wisconsin, but to my knowledge, in only one other case in the state, in the country, and that is the Duffy case. So
let's take a look at this two-prong test. You mentioned the Manthers case, and that has the two-prong test, as I recall.
It does.
Yes. And so the first is intent. You know, did you intend to hear is... did you intend to use this for residential purposes? You know, that's and then the second addresses actual acts, right? I don't have the exact wording in
actual front act of me.
An actual act of non-use is the second prong of the test. Is it your position that the platting of the land that I've heard you reference, the putting in roads, putting in sewer, putting in utilities, and selling a lot represents an actual act of non-agricultural use?
Absolutely. You hit it right on the head. The purpose, the actual act, is a purposeful action. And it is our position that the purposeful actions are, again, almost, they're like eight or nine of them, starting with the request to rezone the property. That is a purposeful act. The subdividing the property, purposeful act. The and all of the other examples I gave to you. Think of it this way. How can you have five or six houses prop up with farming going on around them? That's a mixed use. That's a muddled use. And the municipality under Menominee Falls Preuss has a right to terminate it. They made choices. There are consequences to choices that you make. Are we done with legal nonconforming? I can move on. Declaration of restrictions that we all have mentioned here, it couldn't be more clear that there was not only intent to restrict the use to only single family residences, but that is yet another purposeful intent to show that they have abandoned their legal nonconforming use. And when they violated, there's no question they violated the legal, declaration of restrictions. They continued to farm the property. So you see, the village tried to work with them for the 4 or 5 years between the time of the rezoning and the time of, finally they'd had enough. They went to court to try to stop these actions. And they were certainly authorized by the legislature and by the deed restrictions themselves to enforce those deed restrictions. 236-293, the legislature states that the public body has a right to enforce restrictions at law or in equity if there is a breach. Their own...
Council, excuse me, that brings us back, unfortunately, to the issue that you wanted to abandon, pardon my bad pun, but the legal nonconforming use.
Yes.
Because the argument being made, and my question is geared toward asking you to respond to it, is that the declarations themselves recognize that it's okay to continue activity that is allowed under the applicable zoning codes. So if in fact the farming, or however we want to characterize it, agricultural use, was a legal non-conforming use under the zoning code, isn't that permissible under the declarations during this, I don't know how to characterize it other than sort of an in-between time where we have sort of a partial residential development, but not a complete one?
I don't agree with that at all, because I don't believe that's what the restrictions state.
Why?
Because they don't say that.
Okay, well, let's go to the language then in section 5.1 of the declaration. To your argument, it says each lot shall be occupied and used only for single family residential purposes and for no other purpose. It then goes on to say no business, commercial, or individual activity except as allowed under applicable zoning codes shall be conducted on any lot in the subdivision.
And no activity under the code is permitted.
But if we determine that the farming or agricultural type of activity, the clearing activity, the lawn mowing is a legal non-conforming use, would you concede that that falls under the exception in section 5.1 of the declaration?
This case entirely turns on whether or not there was a legal non-conforming right to use the property in the manner that you suggest.
It does.
It does.
I agree with you. So this secondary issue really does depend on whether there's a legal non-conforming use, and that is case dispositive, is it not?
In some respects, not necessarily with regard to the injunctive orders that were issued by the court, but it is dispositive of a large part of this case. You are correct. So,
counsel, in one of your earlier comments, in the introduction, it made me think that maybe you knew a little bit about farming, even though you do municipal law. And hay is not something that you have to till the soil and plant, unlike other crops, every year. Is that correct?
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, and so you once hay is there, the field, it comes up the next year and it can come up the next year. There's no, it's not like you're growing corn, you know.
That's
and
true.
So cutting it and removing it is another way of saying cutting the hay, and apparently here, taking the hay, I don't know if they baled it or how they did it, but they took the hay, and they apparently this farmer fed it to his animals. Is that what was going on according to the record?
According to the record, as I understand it, I don't know which livestock ate it, but some livestock ate it somewhere.
Okay. So in haying, you know, you could describe cutting the hay and taking it and feeding it to your animals or livestock. You could describe it that way. I suppose you could also describe it as mowing the lawn and removing it. What's the better description of what was going on here according to the record? And removing the clippings.
The trial court made factual findings here that are reasoned findings that are due some discretion, that this was agricultural use, that it was farming. There's a tractor out there cutting, you know, typically in agriculture, you have to let the hay if it's going to be useful in agriculture, to grow long enough so that it will be able to be bundled, transported, and used to feed animals. If they cut the same grass every week or every 2 weeks, I'd agree with you. That's lawn maintenance. This was farming.
Were the activities that are ongoing now the same as the activities when Slinger objected to assigning an agricultural use classification to this property?
The activities on the whole of the property were not the same.
How? How were they different?
Well, before, they farmed the entire property. After, they put in roads, infrastructure, storm sewer, and they sold lots for residential use. Clearly, they are not the same.
It was my understanding that the case, when it came before us the first time, already had a subdivision ordinance passed through the platting of the property, right?
At the time, yes, the activity was before the rezoning, which was 2006,
right?
And after the rezoning, which was after 2006. The activity before was farming. The activity afterwards was farming plus roads that the village has to plow, has to maintain, storm sewer that the village has to maintain, homes which a village must provide police and fire services for.
Well, I think what I've read, the village thought that having a subdivision was in the village's best interest.
It is.
And that it would benefit the community.
Yes.
And I'm frankly a little at a loss on how you guys got sideways with each other so much on something that should have been a cooperative venture. Developing the subdivision should have been good for everybody, but that's not before us.
Yeah, Madam Chief Justice, I agree with you. And I'm a Johnny come lately. I got this case in my lap in August of this year. So I tried to get up to speed as quickly as I could. My colleague that handled this retired early in this year, and then you folks decided to take this case. And it's an interesting case, though, so thank you for doing that.
My pleasure.
Oh, I don't know who's responsible for. Okay, now I know. So I know that I don't have a heck of a lot of time here. I think that we've dealt with the violation of deed restrictions.
Trey, can I ask you a question just regarding the public policy argument that Attorney Booth put forward in his brief, which is, look, these developments, they happen slowly. And at least if we are doing some of the, I think what we're calling for the purposes of this hearing, the agricultural work, I'm using air quotes, at least we're still using that property that hasn't yet been developed into homes. We're doing something with it instead of just leaving it be. What's wrong with that argument?
This is a problem that is faced by municipalities everywhere. Municipalities obviously are strapped to try to provide services continuing at the same level of services for their taxpayers. You have developers come in and acquire property and hold that property until such time as they think that the market is right to develop it. And then they pull the trigger, they come in and they ask for the rezoning and the subdividing. In those cases, there's nothing you can do about some developer that's holding property on speculation, because if they're actually farming it, that's the use, there's nothing you can do about it. But after they come in and voluntarily ask for that rezoning, they shouldn't be able to have their cake and eat it too. In other words, okay, I'm gonna get everything, I can put it on the market. If we have a downturn in the market, I'll just farm it and I'll pay the $50 per acre under the ag treatment of ag land, as opposed to what should be the case. After they put in this infrastructure, put up a couple homes, farm the rest, they're paying $50 an acre, while the municipality has to go and plow the roads, send fire department to problems with regard to, someone needs medical services or you have a fire, take care of their the infrastructure in there. It's just not fair. And so I would take the position that the municipality, the taxpayers of the municipality are being hurt. Plus, for the payment of those services, the other taxpayers in the municipality are subsidizing their fair, what should be the developer's fair share of the tax burden. They're receiving, and the people that are in the subdivision are receiving benefits for which other taxpayers are sharing some of that burden. That's my response.
So, counsel, is it your argument that it's not just the rezoning? It's the rezoning plus the building of all of the infrastructure if we're looking at going forward in a rule for this court, because clearly there's not a lot of case law on this issue. Right. What would that rule be in your mind of when this shifts?
My position is the ruling of this court should be that the two-prong test of Manders, I believe, should be applied in cases where you have an involuntary rezoning of the property. Where you have a voluntary rezoning of the property, this is an act that abandons. It's an actual act of non-use. It's an act that eradicates that use. And that is as it relates to the first issue of actual rezoning. Our second position is, as you alluded to, when they converted, modified this whole property to put into place this infrastructure and actually sell lots, under the Menominee Falls case, you have a right to terminate. Well, actually, they've abandoned the legal nonconforming use because they've converted it. It's no longer the same use before, during, and after the rezoning.
But even though it's the same, cutting and baling of vegetation, you're saying that's not the same use anymore.
It's not, because you have to look at the whole property. It's the same use on part of the property.
Well, if you look at 10.1 of the Declaration of Subdivision, I think it talks about what the developer can do with unsold lots, doesn't it?
No, it says they can use unsold lots in any manner as to facilitate the sale of the lots. Now, how on earth does farming facilitate the sale?
Well, if you compare a mowed field to one that has never been mowed, and you're trying to sell lots out there, I think you can see it's nicer to have it be a little more tidy. I think the town would want it to be a little, or the village would want it to be more tidy.
It should be tidy. It should be tidy every month, but not with, you know, 6-4 feet of grass growing there and purposefully doing that to farm it. So my position again is it's not the same use before, during, and after. I don't think you can argue that the use of having a single family lot in a farm field is the same use as just having a farm field.
Part of that has to do with how you read this declaration, and that has not been developed in anybody's brief. But you could argue that 5.1 applies to people who actually purchase lots, not to the developer of the lots. And 10.1 applies to the developer, but not the purchasers. But that's a whole other argument. So well, I understand what you're saying, but I don't think this record supports our getting into all of that.
Well, Madam Justice, I can't agree with you because those lots, they're all owned. They exist. Every single lot is owned. It just so happens that the developer owns 98% of the lots.
I understand you could take a different argument. What I'm saying to you is that has not been developed in any brief or anything before a lower court. And to start out now with our decision turning on how we interpret a contract that was made between the developer and the village, it's a little late in the game to pick that one up.
Your Honor, I don't know if counsel is going to hit on any of the remaining points. I think I've got about 1 minute. The complaint about, I don't have 1 minute.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start with the last point that the court made with regard to interpretation of the declaration. I think that involves simply a plain reading of the declaration. It involves common rules of construction when you have a specific section that prevails over a more general section. And also, if there's any ambiguity, public policy in Wisconsin favors free use of the property. So I think those two ideas require that Section 10.1 be applied here and that there is a right to mow the property. For that reason, the injunction should not have been granted. Costs and fees should not have been awarded, and we're entitled to a refund of those. So simple contract construction on that one. There has been no discussion with regard to the retroactive reassessment of the property. It seems today that everybody is assuming that the property is used for agriculture. So that would suggest that the court's retroactive reassessment and determining that for 2009 to 2013 that the property should have been classified as residential was wrong and should not have been retroactively reassessed. But regardless of that, it was retroactively reassessed, and that is not something that is allowed under Wisconsin law. And you need to have the legislature saying that they can, that there can be a retroactive reassessment in order for there to be one. Taxing authority is one that requires express authorization, and there is no express authorization here. And also, there are problems with how that was done. The basis for the reassessment was the town clerk saying, well, I think the property should have this value. There's an affidavit that specifies that. And that was the basis. That completely ignores the requirements of the taxing authority. It's required to be done by an assessor. It's required to have certain procedures. It's required to have the procedures that were looked at when this court took up the first TOMA case in 2014. So that was what was supposed to be followed. As far as the forfeitures go and the retroactive reassessment of the property, there is no case that anybody has cited that allows or that specifies abandonment by simply rezoning the property other than the Duffy case. And there are plenty of cases that are contrary to that. There is no case that makes a distinction between voluntary and involuntary. The purposeful act, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley asked about what the purposeful act is. The purposeful act here is the activity itself, the legal nonconforming use. Was that discontinued or not? And it was not. And that is an indication of intent. It is also an actual act of whether or not it's an element of the two-pronged test. Counsel cited the Price case in support of his position that the development of the property is an expansion that is appropriate or that defeats the nonconforming use argument, and that's just not the case. The Price case, there was an expansion of the nonconforming use. In this case, when you put in roads, when you put in sewers, that reduces the amount of nonconforming use. And so that is in line with the public policy in Wisconsin of fostering the reduction of the nonconforming use and fostering the conforming use. That's what occurred here. It did not occur in Price. In Price, the nonconforming use was expanded. Bottom line is, on all three of the bases for award of cost, forfeitures, retroactive reassessment, and the injunction, I'm told to stop.
Well, that's okay. You can finish your sentence. You didn't have to stop in the middle of the sentence.
Okay. All of the bases for those three assignments of damages or reassessed taxes, the bases do not exist, and public policy does not exist to support those. It's bad public policy.
Okay. Thank you very much. And thank you both for a very complicated case. Really, it was complicated the first time I was up here, and it's more complicated this time. But you did very well in oral argument, both of you, and we appreciate your efforts and your participation in this form of argument. We are going to adjourn now, and the court will meet in closed conference at 1:30 this afternoon. We are adjourned.